He pointed to a small chamber in a different part of the temple from that which I had been studying, and I saw a young and very lovely maid, scarce 15 years of age, lying slumbering on a pile of very soft cushions. She had evidently wept herself to sleep, for the tears trembled still upon the long, dark lashes, which veiled the lustrous dark eyes. Her long, dark hair hung about her slender, childish form like a veil of night. Her delicate features were beautiful in the extreme, and her skin white as snow and tinged on either cheek with a color as faint as the most delicate tint of a blush rose, while her slightly parted lips were red as the beautiful sea coral. As I gazed upon her as one spellbound, I had a vague feeling that she was strangely familiar to my eyes, and then I remembered the vague half-seen visions of my boyhood, when I had dreamed of what the realization of my ideal of love was like, and I knew that this girl, this lovely, innocent child, was the embodiment of those dreams, her face the one which had haunted all my dreams of love, till the actual vision of Zuleika had put the childlike one to flight and supplanted it with the more material allurance of her attraction, an attraction which had never sufficed to satisfy the vague longing of my heart for my unseen ideal. Zuleika had awakened the love of my passions, this child stirred to its depths the emotion of my soul. I forgot all things as I gazed upon her. I forgot that I was a spirit and she a mortal, and that between us there rose the barrier of her earthly state. I forgot also mine own aged form in the young ardor of my heart. I forgot even her peril. I was lost to all thoughts but the one thought of her innocent loveliness, her helpless youth. The voice of the angel recalled me to the realities of the moment. "Yea," said he, "she is indeed your twin soul, born into life in the heavenly spheres in the same moment as your own, and travelling thence to find again her reunion with you. The twin souls are as two halves of a golden circlet, each broken and incomplete without the other, yet united they form the perfect whole, the magic circle of love, whose existence had no longer either beginning or ending. The golden ring that men place upon the finger of their brides is the symbol of this perfect reunion. It shall be your task to guard this maid, and ward off from her the dangers of the earthly life. But see that you forget not to hold your own passions well in check. See that you art not betrayed into any loss of your own self-control, or your own calmness of judgment, else will your power to aid her vanish, and your weapons of defense become as broken reeds." At this moment I saw the door of the room open softly, and the evil face of one of the priests appeared. He looked cautiously around, then stealthily glided in, shading with his hand a small lamp that he carried, and crept noiselessly and slowly forward that he should awake his victim before he had reached her, and her cries should arouse others in the temple. At this sight a perfect tempest of rage filled my soul, and without a moment's thought I plunged down towards the temple as a diver plunges into the sea. But the moment my spirit body touched the semi-material cloud that hung around the building, my passage was arrested, and instead of penetrating into it I floated on its surface, its density being as great compared to the lightness of my spirit body, as water is to a piece of cork, and I was as unable to sink down through it, as the cork is to sink under water. Half frantic in my anxiety, I called upon the angel for help. And as I did so I saw that he was rapidly gathering from the atmosphere of this cloud I found so impenetrable long threads of parti-colored vapor, for they were as immaterial as streams of gas, and as fine as the strands of a spider's web. As I turned to look at him, he suddenly threw over me the mass of vapory material he had been weaving, and as it fell around me like a robe I found that I was clad in a complete body of the astral plane, a body so heavy in comparison with my own spirit that it felt like a suit of heavy armor, while my gray robes changed to the color of black. No longer did the cloud of astral vapor resist my passage. I sank down like a stone sinking through water, and ere the vile priest could touch my beloved, I stood between them. In the anger of the moment, the instinct of my earthly life came back to me, and involuntarily I felt in my girdle for my dagger that I might stab the treacherous hound where he stood. But weapon I had none save my hands, and I tried to grip him and fling him to the ground. And even as I had found when in my spirit body I had sought to attack Selim, the earthly body of the priest acted like a case of slippery armor of which my spirit hands could gain no grip, and the man crept steadily on. Trembling with rage and apprehension, I looked around to see if there were no means at hand to aid me, nothing whereby I could arrest his progress. And at that moment a fearful temptation assailed me, for I saw that, following the priest like a flock of evil birds, there came a troop of those horrible semi-human astrals who had killed Salim at my bidding, and for one brief instant I was tempted to bid them aid me by killing this vile man. Only for one brief instant, I thank God. The next I remembered the warning of the angel to keep control of my own passions, and with a cry to him for aid, I stepped back and stood between the furtively gliding priest and the still sleeping girl. As I did so, a sudden light streamed down into the room and lit up the corner where I stood, and in that moment I knew that I had become visible to the startled priest, for he dropped the lamp with a crash upon the floor and sank involuntarily upon his knees in the extremity of his surprise and alarm. "Get you gone, you shameless coward, you vile unholy priest," cried I, in a voice that trembled with rage in spite of all my efforts to steady it. "Get you gone, and pollute not the sacredness of this chamber of holy innocence with your presence. Hast you no fear of those gods whom you dost profess to worship, since you wouldst lay your sacrilegious hands on one whom you did say was to be dedicated to their service? Art you not afraid that you wilt call down the lightning of the offended deity upon your evil head?" And I advanced menacingly towards the now abjectly cowering priest. But ere I had taken two steps towards him, he sprang up and rushed in wild terror from the room. Had I possessed the material bodies of half a dozen mortal men, I could not so effectually have rooted him, or set up so strong a barrier against his return, as my sudden appearance in the spirit had done. Chapter 18 A Second Danger to I am tempted and again fall. As the priest vanished, the light also died out, and I turned to speak to the child, who had sprung up in the first moment of her alarm, but who, with a self-control rare in one of her sex and age, had forborne to cry out. I had once more become invisible, but I could still make my voice audible, and I answered her that she had nothing to fear, as I was there to protect her. "Who art you?" said she softly. "Art you an angel, or one of the patriarchs whom God had sent because I prayed to him last night?" Her words gave me a strange pang, for they reminded me that though my heart was young, yet my own acts had given me the body of an old man, while she was but a child. And I answered sadly, "I am no angel, neither am I a patriarch. I was not old when I left the life of earth. I am only a poor spirit who loves you, and would guard you from all harm." "And if you art a spirit, why doth your voice sound so sad?" replied she tenderly. "Are not all the good spirits happy in heaven?" "Yea, but I am not in heaven," said I am not fit for heaven yet, O fair child. To be near you and to help you is as paradise to me, for I long for someone to love me, and methinks you wilt do that surely, my sweet maid." "I will love you if that will make you less sad," said she simply. "I have left all I love behind me, and I too am sad. Ah! Why was I brought here?" she wailed suddenly in a burst of childish grief. "Why did the gods wish for me? I was so happy with those I loved. Why should the gods, who have all the world to worship them, seek to make me also come to serve them? I prayed to them in our little valley every day, but I feel as though I could not pray to them in this place. Its air stifles me, and these grim walls only make me weep." Then I drew very near to her, and kneeling down beside her put my arms around the gentle child as tenderly as her mother might have done, and I drew the pretty head unto my bosom, and pressed my kisses softly upon her cheeks and trembling lips, and stroked with my hand the long, flowing hair, till I soothed her grief. I whispered to her that she should not stay there long. I would help her to go away, for the gods sought not to imprison any one between four gloomy walls, that it was only men, ignorant men, who did that, and that God would send his good angels to guard her and help her. And so at last she fell asleep with one arm around my neck, and her fair head resting on my shoulder. My strange astral body still clothed me, but its material form had faded away again, while the room, as I have said, was in darkness once more. I think I must have passed an hour or so of earth time while I thus held my beloved in my arms, when again the door opened softly, and this time a woman entered. Such a woman. Such an unhappy, degraded specimen of her sex. With haggard, sunken eyes, wild hair, and half-clothed figure. She was still young in years, but old in shame and misery. In this poor creature I recognized another victim of the evil men within this temple of evil. I saw that she had once been as fair and innocent as the child beside me, and had been dragged down step by step to her present level of degradation. I saw that, strange as it may appear, she cherished a wild, mad love for the man to whom before all others she owed her ruin, and that with the instinct of jealousy, she had divined his passion for the fair girl in my arms and had watched him enter and leave the chamber, though she little guessed why he had fled so hastily, and thought that it was because he had heard some noise in the temple. In a half-crazed fashion, the unfortunate woman had conceived a violent hatred for the innocent girl who had last attracted the notice of the man to whom she still clung, and she had resolved to poison the object of her dislike. As she approached, I observed that she carried in her hand a small phial, one drop of which was certain death to those who inhaled its odor. She also carried a rose, and as she drew near to the girl she put down her little lamp and dropped two drops from the phial into the heart of the rose, and then drew near the sleeper. For the second time that night a terrible temptation assailed me. This time it was my love that made me weak. For as I looked at the poor degraded woman and thought that the gentle child in my arms might be menaced by a similar fate, while I might be powerless to save her, the thought came to me of how sweet it would be were she to die now, so young, so pure, so unsullied by the contamination of the earthly life, and thus place the barrier of death between her and all danger, while death would also withdraw that barrier of mortality that interposed so cruelly between my soul and hers. How sweet to let her earthly body die, and then take her fair spirit to dwell with me in the spirit land forever. Some voice of warning whispered to me that to do so would be no less a murder than if my own hands administered the poison, but I put the thought aside, and argued with myself that I had nothing to do with it, I had only to stand aside for one moment and the deed was done, and my beloved would waken no more on earth, but in my arms she would wake in the spirit world. Was she not my twin soul? Had I not found her at last, and who then could part us? And like an avenging spirit death answered me. For as I argued with myself the woman had drawn near enough to drop her poisoned flower upon my darling's breast, and in one instant before I had well realized what had been done, a faint tremor passed over the slender frame, then another and another more violent, and then the sleeping earthly form I held lay still. Asleep forever. Chapter 19 My Punishment. At first, a wild joy possessed me. I kissed and kissed again the still warm body that lay in my arms, and then a chill fear crept over me, for the spirit within stirred not at my touch, it lay still, as if soul and body alike were dead. I looked around me for someone to aid me, or explain why the soul released not itself from that form of clay, and came to nestle in my breast. And I saw floating down from the far heavens a group of white angels. They seemed to come from a far-off silver star, which I could dimly see, and they floated down and down to where I knelt beside my love. They were 12 in number and their silver wings shone with a brightness that well nigh blinded mine eyes. They had brought with them a car, shaped like a wild white swan and lined, I thought, with softest down. They spoke not to me, but motioned to me to stand aside. I pressed one last kiss upon the unconscious lips of my dead love, and then, like one who moves in a strange dream, I drew back, and let them form a circle round my darling. I saw them making passes over the silent form with their white hands as they hovered around the bier, and then at last I saw the spirit rise through the body as though it had been a covering of vapor, and the white angels bow their heads as though in prayer, while their extended arms received the newborn spirit. Then they laid it in the couch of snowy down and gathered with outspread wings around it. I tried to go near to look at my beloved, to touch her, to follow her, for the vague fear of some great catastrophe was clutching at my heart and turning its warm blood to ice with the anguish of a growing despair. And the angels waved me back, and one who seemed like a man with a shining helmet of silver turned to me and said, "You canst not follow her now. For she belongs to the spheres of the silver star, and within those spheres only those souls, which are pure and unsullied by all the evils of earth, can enter. You canst not touch her now, for your hands are soiled with the things of earth, and your garments are dyed with the crimson stain of its passions." His voice fell upon mine ear with the clear, cold ring of a silver bell, unrelieved by a single touch of pity or compassion. His calm, pure, lofty expression changed not as he pronounced my doom, for mighty in their perfect purity as are these angels of the silver star, their souls beat not in response to human woe, for they have never gauged the depth of human suffering. And as the angels spread their glittering silver wings and floated away with my beloved, I sank upon the dull earth in utter despair, for now I knew what I had done in the madness of my passion, now I realize the full, deep measure of death's bitterness, and that in this hour I had both found and lost my love, my twin soul. Chapter 20 My guide shows me my error, the destruction of the temple. I was aroused at last from my despair by the voice of the angel of the golden star calling unto me, and as I rejoined him he said somewhat sadly, "You hast failed in the task set before you, yet I marvel not, for well do I know how strong are the more selfish emotions of our souls, and that only after long and patient efforts can we learn to hold our love and our hate alike in subjection. Grieve not too hopelessly for Lanth, twin soul, your lost love, for though you canst not follow her, your love will draw her to you again hereafter, and you canst weave a ladder of good deeds and earnest efforts to purify your soul, by which you shall climb up to meet her in the realms of the glorious golden star. It is true that had you but resisted this temptation, you wouldst have reaped joy where now you hast gleaned sorrow, for you couldst have drawn her away from yonder temple of iniquity, and you might have known many happy hours as the guide of her earthly steps, till she had gathered the knowledge, which the earth life was intended to give her, and then might she indeed have joined you in the spirit lands. As it is, she will have to gain her experience by other means, and you wilt have to labor upon this earth plane for many years ere you shall wipe away the stain upon your soul which your acquiescence in her murder had put upon it. Nay, start not, the motive that inspired you was different from that of the actual doer of that deed, but you was nonetheless a partaker in it, for your hand might have stayed hers, and you might have saved that wretched woman from staining her soul with yet another sin had you made one effort to do so. I reproach you not. Rather do I grieve for you, because your own conscience will be your severest judge, and your own empty heart, your hardest punishment. I bowed my head at the angel's words, for in very truth my punishment seemed greater than I could bear. Again the angel aroused me from my bitter thoughts by saying, "Look yonder. See the means of deliverance that were drawing near unto your beloved, and observe how the warriors of the air have enlisted a great host of earthly warriors to help them pull down the temple." As he spoke, he pointed to the crest of the hills whereon the temple stood, and I saw the mighty army of a rival nation come pouring like a living flood down upon the temple and its defenders, attacking them on all sides, and overwhelming them with their superior numbers. I saw the two armies of the light and dark spirits contending in the air and urging on those on earth to the conflict, the dark spirits seeking desperately to inspire the failing courage of the defenders of the temple, while the light spirits forced on their assailants in such a determined fashion, that one point of vantage after another was gained, till the very inner doors of the sanctuary were reached. Here the priests, rendered desperate by the death that threatened them from every side, made a most courageous resistance, contending for every foot of the sacred ground. Then I saw the woman who had killed my beloved rushing like an incarnate fury from place to place with a burning torch in her hand and setting fire to one thing after another till the thick smoke rose in clouds, and the fierce flames drove victors and vanquished alike to seek what safety they could find in flight. The glittering treasures of the temple that had attracted the cupidity of the assailants having to be abandoned to the all-engulfing flames. As the fire was at its height, I looked down again to see if the earthly body of my lost love yet lay upon its bier, and as I did so I shuddered in horror, for the mad woman who had set the temple on fire was standing beside it amidst the fierce flames and the suffocating smoke, screaming out in wild joy as first the bier and then the still form upon it were caught by the curling wreath of flame. Then the roof fell in with a crash, and the body of the murderess and her victim were alike consumed in one funeral pyre. Chapter 21, Astral Shells of Earthly Bodies, Their Nature and Functions in Life and Their Appearance After Death, The Three Fluids or Auras of Physical Life, The Perfect and Psychic Natures, The Difference of Mediumistic Qualities Explained, Vampire Astrals, How to Distinguish Astral Bodies from Spirit Bodies, The Three Bodies, Material, Astral, Spiritual, Found in Every Plane, Solid, Fluidic, Luminous, Shudder Not, said the angel, it were better so, for the purifying fire will quickest release the souls of the poor child and the sin-stained woman from all earthly chains, and in the dark realms of the lower spheres, you must seek out this woman's spirit and help it to find repentance and purification. In so doing you shall atone for your own share in her sin. You canst do nothing now because her soul must find rest for a time ere it wakes in the dark regions whither it has gone. Do you then come with me now, and I shall show you why it is best that the mortal envelope be consumed with fire rather than laid in the tomb to decay. The angel touched me and together we floated away from the scene of horror till we reached a large burying place on a hillside. The graves were hollowed out of the rocks, and the bodies were in many cases carefully embalmed and wrapped in mummy clothes, that they might resist decay as long as possible. See, said the angel, a class of astral life you hast not studied yet. He pointed as he spoke to the crumbling mortal bodies, and I saw that over each there hung a horrible and more or less decayed replica of the living form, a wax-like copy of the body's appearance at the moment of death. In the lees of those who had been dead for long years the astral shells were far gone in decay, but with those only a few years dead the forms were very complete. You wilt observe, said the angel, that the astral shell of one just dead is slightly larger and slightly coarser in appearance than the mortal body was in life. It wears the impress of death in its expression because that was the last change the living soul imprinted on it at departure, but in life the astral shell, like the mortal envelope, reflected the thoughts of the soul it covered. It is larger than the mortal envelope because it was the outer covering of it. It was, in fact, that cover, which interposed between the material body and the atmosphere of the astral plane, and it was the means by which the soul drew from the astral plane those subtle elements of life upon which the spirit body subsisted while imprisoned in the material husk. Observe that the astral shell is like a spongy covering to all the organs of the body. It permeates through every part, enclosing within its slightly larger bulk every atom of materiality with an atom of this astral substance. Its nature is like that of a sponge, for it draws to itself and absorbs the vital magnetism in the atmosphere as a sponge sucks up water. You dost know how by attraction a piece of cloth will suck up all the fluid contained in a jar of water, though only one corner of the cloth be dipped in it. It is then by such an unconscious mechanical action that the astral shell sucks up the life magnetism of any living body with which it may come in contact, as well as what is contained in the life waves that circulate through the universe. During its attachment to the mortal body to which it belongs, it keeps up the equilibrium between the astral and material life principles by this means, and it remains attached to the dead body as long as there is any of the material magnetism left in it, and while so attached it serves to keep it from that rapid decay, which would ensue were all connection between them to cease. Dost you mean that this astral shell supplies the dead body with a degree of vitality? I asked. Yes. But in so infinitesimal a degree that it is not perceptible to mortal senses. The function of the astral shell in life was to thus supply the mortal body, and so long as it remains attached to it, it continues to mechanically perform this function, and so long as it thus supplies a measure of life to the mortal body so long will that body act as a clog tied to the spirit, and preventing it from separating from the earth plane, for the attachment between body and spirit must be severed entirely before the soul can rise into the second sphere. Fire, which is an element at once material and astral in its nature, acts upon the atoms of the astral shell as well as upon the material atoms, and disintegrates at one operation the two envelopes, thus freeing the soul from both. Now you will observe that as the capillary attraction, which the astral shell exercises on all the vital fluid within the range of its attractive powers is a purely involuntary action on its part. It requires no intellectual life in the astral shell in order to cause it to thus draw life out of living things, and you will see how after the death of a person his astral shell, if left still integrate, can suck up the life of mortals and become a source of danger to them, so that a constant course of visits to a cemetery where an immense number of such astral bodies in a fresh state are congregated, results in a gradual loss of vitality, so constant and so great that the mortal fades away and dies, literally because the astral life has been sucked out of his body faster than he could, with his own astral body, absorb it again in sufficient quantity to sustain that equilibrium between the astral and material vital fluids upon which, as we have said, the vitality of the mortal form is sustained. Now there is yet another circumstance that I would have you notice. It is this, that the astral shell, while it sucks up and attracts vitality to itself, is also subject to the force of attraction exercised over it by a form of magnetism, which is at once stronger and more subtle than the quality of magnetism on which it subsists. This finer form of magnetism we call the astral magnetism of the soul, and it is only found where the soul is present, since it is an attribute of the soul itself, and departs with it at its severance from any of the many bodies that successively clothe the soul. In some mortals this magnetism is so covered over with the thick layers of materiality that very little indeed escapes during mortal life, the material envelope being a non-conductor serves as a solid case to keep it in. Such mortals will therefore not attract these astral shells left by their departed fellow mortals, and may therefore visit burying places of the dead without any harm, and they are of all others the persons best fitted to perform the necessary offices for the dead, or to act as attendants in sickness, for they will neither absorb infection nor attract to themselves the astral bodies of those whom they attend. There are, however, others so thinly veiled in materiality that their spirits permeate through all the fibers of their mortal bodies, and their astral magnetism radiates from them in a circle extending often to a considerable distance, and drawing to them all forms of astral life and astral parasites so that life is gradually absorbed from them, and they pass into spirit life to lie in a state of unconsciousness for years. Mortals cannot discern why they have declined, drooped and died, and say that the gods have taken them because they love them, whereas they have simply fallen victims to the prevailing ignorance of mankind on the subtle subject of astral influences. You hast been accustomed to think of fire as the most natural means for promoting the disintegration of the body because you did belong to a faith, which looked not for a resurrection of that actual body of mortality with which you did part at death, but it is nations such as this nation whose mortal envelopes we are now surveying, who, teaching that the mortal body would rise again, sought to facilitate its resurrection by retaining it in as perfect a state of preservation as they could. They clung to the envelope that they could see because they were unable to comprehend truly the idea of the soul's existence in a conscious state apart from matter, and they had not grasped the fact that matter may pass through conditions which sublimate it as well as the soul, till it becomes a fit covering for the immortal soul, although no longer visible to the coarse degree of mortal sight. The only body they can conceive of as rising again is the mortal one, and hence their desire to prevent the disintegration of its particles. You wilt now observe that on closely regarding the freshest of these astral shells before us you canst perceive an infinite number of minute suckers projecting from the whole surface of the astral body. These suckers are like the antennae of the fly, but much more minute even than they are, and by the magnifying powers of spiritual sight, we can see that the surface of the astral body resembles that of a fine sponge, the minute suckers being like the tiny points of the spongy surface. When an astral body attaches itself to a living mortal, it is by means of those suckers that it holds on, while it draws the vitality of its victim away like some parasitic plant that has fastened on a tree. To remove one of these astrals, it is necessary to apply a strong dose of ether saturated with vitriolic acid. This substance, when in a vaporized condition, acts most powerfully upon all forms of astral life, and causes the astral shell to shrivel up as though vitriolic acid had been thrown upon a mortal body. but as the mortal has also his astral envelope covering his mortal body, and as it is upon that the astral parasite has fastened, it requires great care to use this means of freeing the mortal without also injuring him. Moreover, when you hast destroyed the adhesive power of the astral parasite's own suckers, you may find that you hast also injured those of your charge, since the chemical has acted upon both.